Hello, Joe. Would you mind reading something out to our lovely listeners?
Okay, I will read something out for our lovely listeners.
It's just this here.
Yes, I know. Okay. It is undeniable that they have become a pleasing double act, discussing the giants of early 18th century satire in an audience-friendly manner. They are erudite but not obtuse, and return frequently to a lively discussion about whether satire actually has any point.
Now, Joe, what do you think that is a review of?
Well, I know what I think it's a review of, but shall I do like a funny answer instead? Is it a review of Satirical Spotlight, the ChatGPT imaginary podcast with host one and host two?
Do you know what? It wouldn't surprise me if that did get a review. After we've been trying to extort reviews from listeners for years, it wouldn't surprise me if that did get one. But no, it's not a review of that.
Is it a review of Smith and Moore talk about satire?
Interesting that you think that.
I don't think that. I know what it is and I'm pretending, but go on.
Doesn't that sound just like us, though?
It does sound just like us.
Part of the 18th century thing.
But, what do you mean apart from the 18th century?
Well, I mean, we're not an 18th century double act, are we? But we do talk about the 18th century sometimes.
Well, I know you've been listening to our back catalogue, haven't you, with the satire and women thing, where you talk about 18th century satire for like 6 hours straight and then go, it's time for the 18th century corner.
It's fine.
What did people think in the 18th century and why?
Laughing at our own back catalogue.
Yeah,
it did make
this
me smile when you said
Mitch's
But the point is
but it's not us. It's not Satirical Spotlight.
No.
Is it that Frank Skinner thing?
It's a show that's literally called Skinner and Mina.
Talk about
this literary journey. Semicolon, Pope and Swift. But yeah, on the Twitter, they're going by Skinner and Mina. And it's even got the and sign.
Wow, who would have ever thought of using an ampersand if it wasn't for us?
I know.
Plagiarism gone mad, that, isn't it?
Well, that's what I was going to say. They really have stolen
it. Did they use
the
alphabet as well to write it?
They did.
And speak in English as
they
well.
They did. Someone needs to tell them. We're the only podcast. We have a male and female host
joined by
an ampersand who talk about satire.
I can't believe you think the ampersand is significant. But so, is the point here then that there is a hungry appetite out there for interesting, lively people to have audience-friendly discussions about the giants of 18th century satire?
It is, yes.
Yeah,
and
we should get on the telly.
We should. So, let the music play and then we'll do exactly that.
Yes.
Music. I don't suppose you've seen the show Skinner and Mina.
I didn't see it. I
Swift
think it might be on a channel I don't have.
Yeah. So this is the issue I've had. It's on Sky. It's on Sky Arts, which I don't
feel like
have.
That sometimes pops up on Freeview and sometimes not.
But fortunately, it was Mother's Day this weekend, so I went to see my parents. And whilst I was there, they have Now TV. So I suggested maybe a nice thing for us to do as a family would be watching
something
about
Mother's Day treat.
Would be
for us
to watch something that aligned with my interests.
Yeah.
Which was this TV programme. And I've got to
say, was it
good? Yeah. Like, I was really... I don't know how you feel. How do you feel about documentaries for the public about, for example, the Brontes or the 19th century or Victorians? What's your mental state as you approach that?
I watch them expecting and anticipating that I'll be, like, sitting there. I might get at least one smug moment where I'm like, oh, I can't believe they're doing like that myth or they don't know something obvious or whatever. Yeah, I perhaps don't watch them in the same way as I might read something about them for work, but I kind of do want to see them.
Yeah. So I went into this. I mean, it's very rare for there to be a documentary in this much detail about my field, for Swift and Pope, and specifically it's about satire as well. So I went into it knowing that it's for a public audience, knowing not to hold it to too high a standard.
Sky Arts is fairly highbrow, though.
It is. But I thought, you know, they've got no. They're telling a story, so just calm down. Don't get too het up. But I was anxious. I don't know what I thought was going to happen. But I was like, if they say something that really upsets me about Swift and Pope, I don't know what I'm going to do. It's going to really bother me. But it was really good. I thought it was really good. So Frank Skinner is. And it's his idea. He created it. I noticed at the end it said created by Frank Skinner, and I'm sure that they have researchers who feed them the stuff, but he did seem genuinely enthusiastic about Pope and stuff. But for my tastes, he overacted a bit. The bits where they're saying, like, this person has transformed our understanding, that never again will language be the same. And he's like, gurning and waving his arms around and like bending in the middle with enthusiasm of how important Alexander Pope is. That stuff made me cringe.
That's quite an image. Frank Skinner's sort of like twisting up like an aging embryo, getting excited about Jonathan Swift.
Fists crunched together, yeah. Bending in the middle, like you do when someone scores a goal, and like saying to the camera, like, no person ever has contributed to the English language what Pope has. So that, I mean, I'd love to see it, but it was a bit, that was a bit much, a bit panto.
Yeah, satire's coming home.
But once they got over that, and they got into talking about it all, really, some really interesting stuff. So something that I'd never considered, I knew it as a fact, but I never really thought about it, is that Swift was so much older than Pope. He's like 20 years older than Pope. So that's an interesting characteristic between their dynamic. Also, the Pope was autodidact.
Autodidact.
Like Lee Stein.
Yeah.
Because he couldn't go to university or school because he's Catholic, whereas Swift has come through Oxford and all of that. So there's interesting dynamics between the two of them. But their readings of the poems, they get into Whig and Tory politics. They talk about all the things I talk about in quite a lot of detail, which is surprising. And there's one scene where Frank Skinner's explaining how scansion works, like meter, by banging on a tree and saying that you might think it's unfortunate that Pope always uses the same metric patterns, but he's like, it's like reggae, the same patterns in infinite variations. And I just thought, well, I never thought I'd see a TV program which is marketed at a mainstream, well, Sky Arts, but like a mainstream audience. It was a popular thing where someone's talking about 18th century politics and satire and meter.
Do you
in this
feel
detail.
Like there's kind of no point in your continued existence then if Frank Skinner's doing it all much better?
Well,
he's on telly,
it's different,
not.
Isn't it? Because I'm doing it most, I mean, we enjoy doing the podcast and I hope we do explore these ideas, but we're doing it a slightly different way. He's trying to explain everything that I've ever done in three episodes.
That's why I think you might feel there's nothing left for you. He's going to do your life's work in three episodes and he's going to get paid more for them than you will in your entire career.
Yeah.
Think on.
I suppose there is that. And also, obviously, there's the two of them. So you've got Denise Mina, who's a crime writer, but also now a comic writer. And as in, she writes comedy, not comics. And so she kind of represents Swift and tells Swift's story, and he tells Pope's story. So there's bits of it where it feels like The Trip or something like that, because they're driving from one place to another. Very, very... I can't believe it exists. I'm very impressed.
Yeah, I wish I could see it. You should like get back at him by writing a song about football with David Baddiel or something.
Yeah.
That would be good.
I did send his agent a message.
Did you?
Just to see if he'd like to come and talk about it on the podcast.
Did you actually?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I've not heard yet back. I've not heard back yet, but...
Not
Avalon?
Back yet heard. Yeah.
Check your emails.
Okay. Well, that's very exciting, isn't it? And also, you've got something else exciting to talk about, haven't you, about you and the media, where Frank Skinner didn't get there first.
That's true, yes. So, well, somebody contacted both of us, didn't they? A journalist from Poland contacted the both of us. I think what happened is they contacted you first and you were unavailable, and then they came to me.
Oh, so often the way. It's rarely the way.
But yes, Marta Zabuszka. Who's writing a feature inspired by Jeremy Clarkson's comments about Meghan Markle, specifically the comments where he says he lies in bed at night grinding his teeth, imagining her being dragged through the street naked people throwing feces at her.
Right.
So Marta was interested in the backlash to that and the question of whether or not it was satirical, and also what that backlash might tell us or her Polish readers. The press is the second biggest magazine in Poland. What this might tell readers about English sensibilities and whether or not England still has a sense of humour, or whether it's become oversensitive, or whether satire can exist in the current climate and stuff like that. So I spoke to her, and the piece came out. The headline for the piece, it was on the 4th of March 2023, was called White Man Jokes, and the tagline was Clarkson...
Is that a description of you?
Well, I hope not.
Yeah.
Clarkson attacks holy figures who publicise the problem of racism and is in trouble again, and they will come out whole again, is how the...
So that's... obviously that's not what was in the original edition of the article. That's a translation.
That's after it's been translated,
Okay.
So Marta called me and we were on the phone for about half an hour. It was a really good conversation. I do have sympathy for her because I got quite excited about all of this, and she basically got...
Did you start hitting a tree and saying it was like reggae?
I did.
You normally do.
And I was really hungry because I just had a steak, but it wasn't enough, and then I punched a man. No, it's Jeremy Clarkson.
No, he didn't get the steak, did he? Too cold or something.
That's right,
yeah.
No, she got 40 hours of Smith and Ward talk about satire condensed into 20 minutes down the phone.
What a lucky lady.
In a second language. So she's made notes, and then she's written the article, and then she's written it in Polish, and then she sent it to me in Polish, although something I'm really grateful for is she highlighted my section so I could then run them through Google Translate.
Yeah.
And it produced this. So this is... came out of my mouth, was said to Marta. Marta then wrote down a summary, a paraphrase of what I said, then has turned it into Polish, and then has published it, and I've turned it back into English using Google Translate.
Sort of.
And it came up with this. Clarkson, over the years, has built up the image of a white guy who doesn't understand the changing world and says absurd things whilst driving. You could like him or not, but he always stuck to the formula he built himself, believes Adam J. Smith.
Sounds like the sort of thing you would normally say.
Do you think it does?
I mean, I think it says absurd things.
But I think that the essence of what I said, the fact that it can be reduced down to Jeremy Clarkson is a man who presents himself as a white guy, doesn't understand the world, and says absurd things whilst driving, that is it, isn't it? That's Clarkson.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because that is obviously not quite the way, it's not quite the way you would have said it, and it's, I'm sure, not the way that it's written in Polish. But it sounds not dissimilar to if you asked ChatGPT to write a paragraph about Clarkson, doesn't it? Google Translate obviously has as much of a, almost, well, maybe more of a tin ear for language that as ChatGPT does.
Well, it's because something that people don't often talk about...
Algorithms?
Is algorithms.
Algorithms.
No, Google Translate is AI.
Yeah.
Isn't it? It's another kind of AI. But yeah, no, I was really
pleased
with that.
Well done for being in the paper.
Oh, thank you. And well done, Marta, for making sense of my ramblings down the phone.
And well done, Google Translate, for making them funny. Yeah.
And so what else has been happening since we last spoke to our listeners?
Well, we did the York Lit Fest, didn't we?
We did.
And we talked about satirical women in the olden days.
Mm-hmm.
That was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about Lady Mary Montagu.
I did.
And you talked about Mary Wollstonecraft.
I did.
And another one.
Mary Lieper.
That's
all
right.
Same.
All the Marys.
And Eliza Haywood.
And Eliza Haywood.
Jane Collier, author of The Art of Ingeniously Tormenting.
Wow. So you did Mary, 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 Eliza and Jane, and I did Charlotte. That's a bit pitiful, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I did well, loads of women.
Yeah. So I talked about Charlotte Bronte and how she was sometimes satirical towards her family, her life, the village where she lived, and quite often her younger brother Branwell, her first and perhaps keenest literary rival, and some of the sorts of ways that she satirised him in her juvenilia. Did you enjoy that?
I loved it, because we talked about this in the podcast a few months ago, didn't we? In, I think, November, the Brontes and Satire episode. One of my favourite things that any Bronte has ever written.
Oh, you're really taken with this, aren't you?
Yeah.
Is it? Anne is nothing.
Yeah.
Absolutely nothing.
I think it's the and. It's like, and Anne is nothing. Absolutely nothing. That's just such a burn. That's a sick burn.
So this is the one where Charlotte's writing in the character of Benjamin Wiggins, who's clearly a satirical avatar for her brother.
Mm.
And he goes into detail about how Charlotte's short and dumpy, Emily's lean and scant with a face about the size of a penny.
Mm.
And then he just goes, Anne is nothing.
Yeah.
Full stop.
Yeah.
Absolutely nothing. Yeah, but that... So I was interested in thinking about that, and I went away and had a look for it, because I wondered whether Charlotte, you know... Okay, she took the piss out of him when they were teens and young adults. Was that like a kind of anomaly in her relationship with him? And how did that kind of play out more generally? Because you were interested in that
question
as well.
I was. Because I
think of their life as quite sad.
Yes, I think of their life as I'm not alone in this. There's a and actually working with you, you've myth-busted this quite often. But there's a sense that they were just like browbeaten sad women in a horrible village where everyone died all the time.
Yeah.
And the streets were lined with the dead siblings that they had. And it was just completely
They didn't have hedges in Howard. Yeah, no. They didn't have dry stone walls. It just had dead siblings piled on top of one another.
And everyone who hasn't died of typhus has been shot by old man Bronte.
Well, we made that one up, didn't we?
It's depressing and upsetting, isn't it? And when people characterise Emily Bronte...
She was just snarky and sarcastic and sibling rivalry...
Yeah.
Motivated in her youth.
It's a different
kind
view
of them,
isn't
that a little bit, doesn't
totally,
it?
Totally, yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, were you going to say something else there?
No, just like when people talk about the Brontes, or general people, not people like yourself, but people have a sense of it, it'd be like, oh, you know, Wuthering Heights is so raw and emotionally upsetting, and Charlotte is reckoning with all this death and despair, and all the books are about, you know, they're quite melodramatic and upsetting and gothic, and some people say they were wrong. Yes, it's different. It's quite challenging, isn't it, to people's preconceptions, to imagine that in the midst of all of that, they're just making fun of each other as siblings.
Yeah, certainly when they're younger and in better health as well. But it's interesting. So when Branwell died, Charlotte's response is quite interesting, because he'd taken to his bed for a good month or so. He seemed like he sort of had TB, but combined with the long effects of a lengthy, damaging relationship with drugs and alcohol. And when he died, Charlotte wrote to one of her friends, A lull begins to succeed the gloomy tumult of last week. It is not permitted us to grieve for him who is gone as others grieve for those they lose. The removal of our only brother must necessarily be regarded by us rather in the light of a mercy than a chastisement. It's interesting that, she's quite bold about how she writes about it when he's died. Even. Yeah. She says, there is no prop withdrawn, no consolation torn away, no dear companion lost. She says something a bit nicer. She does later say, you know, now that he's gone, I can think about him in the round. I can think about him as a child and how much promise he had. And I forgive him for everything that he put us through, because he did put them through quite a lot. Mm. And she talks about, this one starts quite nicely, I looked on the noble face and forehead of my dead brother. And then she talks about how he'd been favoured with a better complexion and features than any of the girls, and that wasn't fair. So I looked on the noble face and forehead of my dead brother and asked myself, what had made him go ever wrong, tend ever downwards? Like, dead brother, why were you so useless?
Yeah,
interesting.
It's like, I'm not saying I'm glad he's dead.
He'd be quite a sight if he were still alive now, wouldn't he?
Yeah, no, but me paraphrasing Charlotte.
Okay,
it's like
yeah.
She's saying, I'm not saying I'm glad he's dead. But
I'm not sorry either.
Yeah, like there
it's
are
probably for the best.
Some good points.
Yeah. To be fair, like I say, she did kind of reflect a bit that she forgave him and that it was as though the terrible last few months counted for less within the greater scheme of things after she'd had time to reflect. But yeah. I mean, I suppose at least she didn't satirise his corpse.
No.
That would be a step too far.
That's true. That's really interesting, though, reconfiguring our expectations of Charlotte Bronte to encompass and incorporate these ideas that she's doing a kind of, well, it is a juvenile satire to her siblings. She's also a woman, which is why
she was
at our event about comedy, comedic women in the olden days.
I don't know why you were there.
Yeah. And it connects to the interview that we're going to play later today, isn't it?
Women, challenging expectations, olden days things.
Yeah.
Coming up.
Comic women's poetry in the 19th century. But before we get there, there was something that happened in the discussion, which I think we both found really interesting at the end of our event.
Yeah.
Which is where somebody said, based on everything you've said today, do you think there is scope to reconfigure our definition of satire to incorporate or encompass satirical, the way that women have used satire?
Yeah, which would entail less of the sense that the satirist knows how things should be, that they have a really clear sense of what is wrong, are confident that if that thing were changed, things would be better in this very definable way, and so they go about doing that in the hopes of affecting some kind of change.
Yeah,
and it seemed like a lot of the women we were talking about, they were doing things which fitted the category of satire, but didn't necessarily fulfil all of those criteria. So
it was interesting because, so often we've observed that a lot of the names of satirists that people reach for are men. The people who write the definitions or the definitions that we tend to use do tend to be men. And those definitions use a lot of figurative language to describe the acts of satire, which are historically coded as masculine, aren't they? So like violence, hitting, lashing.
Scalpels and swords and what else? Medicine.
Yeah, but it's about attacking something and it's about being clever as well. Being
and as
clever
we all
enough,
know, women can't attack and are stupid, so
no, well that's the point.
This
is Mary Wollstonecraft's idea that women are sunk low by a false education that says that they can't be these things, but it just occurred, it's just a different account for why it is that all the satirists people think of are men, and I think it's because perhaps goes back to that definition or those definitions, because they're coded in ways that we associate with masculinity and being a man. The women do satire and just people don't spot it. Like some of the feedback from the event was people saying, I really enjoyed this event because I never thought of Charlotte Bronte this way, or I never thought of Mary Wollstonecraft as being funny. I mean, I know the obviously Vindication of the Rights of Women isn't a satire, but she makes jokes in it, as we talked about. So I thought we could just talk about that a bit today.
Yeah.
Before we go to the interview. So
have you got a standard definition for satire?
Yeah, by Dustin Griffin. A great man, but also a man. And this is the one that we've talked about on the podcast a few times before. But looking at that again now, Joe, where do you see the kind of masculine coded language in there?
A work of satire is designed to attack vice or folly. To this end, it uses wit or ridicule. Is the word for all of this, by the way, kind of logocentric? Like, there's a purpose and an end and a through line, designs, attack, an end that you're trying to reach. Am I using that word correctly? Mm. I'm never really confident around that one. Like polemic rhetoric, it seeks to persuade an audience that something or someone is reprehensible or ridiculous. Unlike pure rhetoric, it engages in exaggeration and some sort of fiction. Satire usually proceeds by means of clear reference to some moral standards or purposes. If I'm using logocentric right, then I think that's what that is.
Yeah, I thought logocentric was where you focus on the trees in a narrative.
A semantic field of trees and wood. Yeah. And then you hit them and you say it's reggae and it's the same as...
That's scansion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Getting off the topic a bit.
Sorry.
Is that idea of like a linear through line that's clear, that is confidently articulated, that's only going in one direction, all of that is stuff that has been kind of coded male and masculine, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's another aspect of satire, which I think we've touched on before, but it's that like intention is possibly more important than other forms of literature. Like you have to have, it's that logocentric thing again, like the work has an intention. It has decided that a real-world thing is wrong and needs to be attacked.
Yeah. So it's not proposing or suggesting or tacitly implying or anything, is it? It's linear and definitive.
Mm.
Got another one?
Yeah, so this one is Amanda Hillner and Elizabeth Davies in the book British Women's Satirists in the Long 18th Century, which only just came out in 2022. And they made this observation, which I think aligns quite closely with what we're talking about. They said, the prevalent critical association between satire and aggressive masculinity has produced a critical blind spot that obscures the presence of a vital diverse group of women satirists. So that's this masculine language idea that we want, that we
expect. If it doesn't look aggressive, then it can't be satire.
Yeah.
And that might lose a whole group of people, women who are doing satire.
Even though half of satire, well, at least a third of satire is Horatian, historically, which is a gentle mocking satire. But yeah, we look for it to be this Swiftian image of the person who's lacerating their victims.
Yeah.
The alignment of femininity with politeness gave women a new level of rhetorical authority, they continue, and women writers recognised satire as a powerful tool for pursuing social critique and reform. Through its conventions of exaggeration, wit, humour, irony and other devices of indirection, satire afforded women writers a palatable, flexible and intellectually potent vehicle for voicing opinions that would otherwise be deemed too indecorous for a lady.
Interesting. Devices of indirection, flexibility, a vehicle. Yeah, they all imply a bit more kind of movement, a bit more of a sense of this as like a more elastic kind of mode in which to write.
It reminds me, that last bit reminds me of Andrew Bricker and his book about satire and the law, because he talks about how satire becomes necessarily the art of verbal ambiguity. So criticizing people harshly, but in a way where no one can specifically pin in a court of law the target. Everyone will know that McFlakeno is about a particular person, but no one can prove it. And that's where you get the irony and the ambiguity. But that's not very, forgive me, but like if you're going to use the language of this discussion in an 18th century context, that's not very manly, is it? To criticise someone in an ambiguous way.
Yeah.
To subtweet them, basically.
Yeah.
Like, which is also interesting. Like, I was talking to you about this the other day, that when Addison, he talks about all the different genres, he personifies them in this essay in The Spectator, and he personifies satire as a woman who will smile in your face and stab you in the back. So
don't they all?
Well, exactly. Like, so he's playing into that trope. Like, so he's saying satire, and that's interesting because he's a Whig, not a Tory, so he's opposed to the more explicit forms of satire, but he's saying satire is not manly.
Mm.
It's like a backstabbing woman. And he's using that as an insult, perhaps. But yeah, one of the people I was talking about in the event was Jane Collier, who wrote this satirical conduct book called The Art of Ingeniously Tormenting. And she's joking here. So the idea is that it's a book that teaches you how to behave badly and how to nag and irritate people and frustrate people. But she suggests in one moment in this book that rather than stab someone, which is what a lot of satirists pretend that they're doing in their figurative language of violence, she says it's better to waste them over, waste them by degrees over a long amount of time. So here's a quote from it. She says, if I be so happy, my good pupils, the people reading this conduct book, by these hearty endeavours as to instruct you thoroughly in the ingenious art of plaguing and tormenting the mind, you will also have more power over the body than you are at first aware of. You may take the Jew's forfeit of a pound of flesh. Well, this is a reference to the
Shylock,
in The Merchant of Venice,
yeah.
Who wanted to cut a pound of flesh out of someone who owed him a debt. So she says, you may take the Jew's forfeit of a pound of flesh without incurring the imputation of barbarity which was cast on him for that diverting joke. He was a mere mongrel of tormenting, that is to say, not very good at it. To think of cutting it off with a knife? No. Your true delicate way is to waste it off by degrees.
Right, so she is, whether consciously or not, kind of critiquing that standard metaphor of satire where you see a target, you aim for the target, you slice it and excise it. But actually it's better to come at it from all different... Death by a thousand cuts, basically,
yes.
Isn't it? Is better than one big, lovely stabbing.
Yeah.
And you could... What would you choose?
Probably wasted by degrees, I think. Do you think?
What are we talking, literally?
Yeah.
Would you rather somebody who's mean and horrible to you your whole life, or they just one time satirised you really horribly?
I suppose for one time would be better, wouldn't it?
Yeah. But what if it was literal? Would you rather?
I think I'd rather just be a thousand cuts than a pound of flesh.
Really?
Well, yeah. Because like, you'd die if someone cut a pound of flesh out of you, wouldn't you?
Death by a thousand cuts kind of implies death is at the end.
But whilst they're taking the cuts, you're still alive, so you do get a bit longer.
Oh my god, that's the weirdest like take on a glass half full mentality ever. At least when you've got 999 cuts, you are still a bit alive. So
yeah.
There's hope.
Well, I suppose I was thinking the question of like, would you rather be die now or die in a few weeks?
Now, if those few weeks are going to be being spent being stabbed
a thousand times. That's a good point. Maybe I've just revealed too much about myself.
Yeah, you're like.
But also that approach that Collier's suggesting there maybe aligns with what Hilda and Davis is saying. Like, if you are going to kill someone with a thousand cuts, you avoid the vulgar moment that would be indecorous for later.
You don't have to kind of declaim it, do you?
But just something that does complicate the whole thing is that Collier does suggest in the preface to Ingeniously Tormenting that the ultimate tormentor, the model that she imitates, is Swift. Again. So, but I think that's similar to the Addison point. She's saying Swift thinks he's really masculine and he thinks he's a big man, but he's actually like, he's the perfect version of this like heckling, silly, nagging woman that I'm pretending that I'm promoting in this book. So there's a whole question over whether or not in the 18th century, I think, whether or not it is masculine or manly to do satire. But the discourse and the definitions do have entrenched in them this kind of logocentric masculine energy.
Yeah.
Big
logos energy.
Big logos energy. Yeah.
I don't know if that sounds like an energy company or like a...
BLE.
Yeah, or a, I don't know, like a god or something. Big logos energy. How very interesting.
So yeah, so maybe there is scope to redefine satire in a way where, I don't know how we would soften the attack to, or broaden the attack to encompass more subtle ways of hurting people. We need to think of some more examples, don't we, before we
can
determine this.
But then think seriously about redefining what satire is in a way that encompasses the ways that women have done it too, or that we propose a radical reevaluation of what satire is and how it's defined and who does it.
Yeah, I think we should do that.
And one of those people is Charlotte Bronte.
Yeah, for sure. I think it'd be interesting, not today, but I think as a project, would be to find women talking about definitions of satire in the 18th century and beyond as well. To see if there is a difference.
Okay. Should we talk about comic women's poetry of the 19th century now?
Let's do that.
Leads in quite nicely. Who are we going to speak to then?
So we're going to be speaking to Dr. Jasmine Jagger and Dr. Heather Hind. Dr. Jasmine Jagger is author of Rhythms of Feeling in Edward Lear, T.S. Eliot and Stevie Smith. She's been a Leverhulme Early Career Fellow at the University of Roehampton, undertaking a project titled Radical Rhymesters, the Female Comic Spirit in Victorian Verse. And part of that has involved the creation of the open access online database of humorous verses by 19th century women that we'll be discussing today.
And Dr. Heather Hind is the digital research assistant on that project. She's also currently working on a monograph on hair work in Victorian literature and culture, which apparently will focus on works, including works by Charlotte and Emily Bronte.
Amazing.
And Wilkie Collins and Margaret Oliphant.
Amazing.
So yeah, look forward to that. And let's go chat.
Hello, Heather and Jasmine. Thanks for being here. So we're going to talk about your collection of comic women's poetry of the 19th century. Would you maybe start by telling us a bit about how that project came into being and what the premise of it is?
Sure. So the background and premise of the project is that 19th century women's comedy is severely unappreciated in literary criticism and the public imagination. So when one thinks of women poets at that time, we think of Elizabeth Barrett Browning or Christina Rossetti. And on the whole, female poetry of the 19th century has really been perceived as sincere and heartfelt rather than irreverent and saucy, and more inclined to tragedy than comedy. So the project was set up as part of my Leverhulme Fellowship in English Literature at Roehampton University to challenge and correct this perception and really try and encourage people to engage with the comic spirit of women in that century. So what we've done is we've created an accessible, informative and hopefully enjoyable space within which people can explore this kind of huge diversity of women's voices speaking out on everything from politics, science and religion to courtship, marriage and motherhood.
And it is, it's an amazing, and it's an open access archive, which is growing all of the time. It's very, it's just, you can, if you're looking for something in particular, you can search it well. If you're just looking to find something that is quite funny, it's really easy to do so as well. It's a great resource. The next question on the script was, can you tell us who the 190 women collected in the project are? We just realised there was a typo when I sent this to you, and it said, can you tell us how the 190 women are? So,
well, they're all dead.
So who are they?
Not doing too well.
Yeah.
But who are the women that are writing these poems?
So we found all sorts of women from all walks of life, everyone from kind of, middle class writers, but also to factory girls, servants, housekeepers. We've got farmers' wives, scientists, suffragists, as you might expect, but also anarchists, radicals, atheists and religious zealots, artists, actresses, spinsters, and lots of them, but also queer women, cross-dressing women, gardening enthusiasts, animal lovers, and really women that were interested in all sorts of things for all sorts of reasons. You will find some women poets that might be familiar to you, like Christina Rossetti or Maria Abdi, but also lots of names that you will not have come across before because they maybe only published a couple of humorous poems in some rather niche periodical. So yeah, as Jasmine was saying, a whole kind of diverse range of voices.
And so I was thinking, like, we're kind of getting there, aren't we, on the idea that women in the period could be political or could be opinionated or could have like some knowledge about science or the kinds of disciplines that traditionally women in the long 19th century weren't associated with. But it feels like quite an important last piece of the puzzle to say yes, and they were also funny. It seems to me, and I'm interested in thinking about why kind of claiming them as comic women might be useful and interesting, but and we'll see if we get to that. But what are you able to sort of summarize what kinds of comedy they're doing? What are the ways in which they're funny? And I guess for us, are they ever satirical, do you think?
There's a wide range of comic tones being employed here, from the deadpan, indignant and wiseacre to the openly satirical. And satire is actually one of the largest sort of uses, largest kinds of comedy being used over the 1000. So we've tagged poems under different kinds of humour. So you can actually search the collection by saying, just typing in irony. I want to see how irony was used by the women in the 19th century, or, you know, I want to see how nonsense was being used. So there's just this really nice broad range of different kinds of comedy. But for me, the most illuminating and revealing thing about the way in which women use satire in particular is that the poems are really, I mean, as you were just saying, like they're just really radically feminist a lot of the time. And that these women kind of use comedy and the music of poetry as a vital way to approach taboo topics and articulate personal and collective grievances. So these are the poems of the jilted lovers and the disgruntled mothers of the abused servants and the battered wives. And the everyday women of the 19th century for whom satire becomes a kind of mouthpiece.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned like
tagging them, and it's very useful to search them according to tags. But what's kind of your definition of how do you determine if a poem is comic or humorous? And I'm revealing my own 18th century background here, where everything could either be extremely conservative or extremely ironic. But like, how did you decide like what's a comic or humorous poem? What are your criteria?
For me, it was kind of, you know, I guess it's different for us both, but for me, it's sort of if it brings a smile, I think it's sort of it's humorous. So that was kind of my way of deciding whether or not. But then there are some poems that bring a smile that sort of in their kind of the lightness rather than the humorousness. So it was quite difficult sometimes. Heather and I, it was good to have two readers deciding whether they were funny mm-hmm. or not. I think I sent one to Heather just last week being like, is this funny? Like, it's about a grasshopper, but is it funny?
So yeah.
Is it funny?
No. No. Yeah.
I was just in a quiet of a kind of light mood, and I guess I kind of thought that it was funny to like talk in detail about this grasshopper, but Heather reminded me that no, it was actually very sincere.
Yeah, and that's a line that comes up quite often as you're saying, sometimes you read a poem and you think, this is so sincere, is it taking the mick? And maybe that's just to do with how you read it. But me and Jasmine have to bounce poems off against one another sometimes after reading so many, just to check that we're still tuned into something that is definitely humorous.
There's a fundamental kind of difficulty and paradox there, isn't there? Because comedy is so subjective. And you were both like clearly like in agreement that the grasshopper wasn't funny. You said that in unison. Do you ever get something that strikes one of you as really quite funny and one of you as not funny in the slightest?
No, although I will say there are quite a lot of in jokes. So often things that would have been funny to them just aren't funny to us because we weren't like we had to be there kind of thing. So yeah. There's quite a lot of contemporary comedy, which is interesting. So it might not make you laugh out loud, but it would have made someone in that time laugh out loud or at least smile. So I do think that's quite interesting. And then there's the more kind of universal kind of comedy where you're just like, well, that is just hilarious and it's just very easy and obvious.
That's so interesting hearing you talk through that, is that problem, because working on satire, teaching satire, this comes, the issue of intentionality comes up all the time in a way that it doesn't, I think, necessarily in other fields of literary study. So you know, when I'm teaching students, I say, well, don't worry too much about what the author was thinking. Let's analyze it for its devices and its terms and then build our own interpretation. But when an author is choosing to satirize something, it's an intervention into an issue. They have a view of what's right and wrong that they're trying to, and it's a bit like that with comedy, isn't it? So if you find a poem, if you both found a poem that made you laugh but wasn't supposed to be funny, that's one version of it. But then there could be one where it's supposed to be funny and just isn't because we don't have the context for it. So they're kind of, so is it more about, are you trying to reconstruct whether or not the author meant it to be funny rather than determine whether or not it is still funny?
Yeah, it's about whether the author meant it to be funny rather than just whether we think it's funny and whether the author was trying to kind of bring a smile to the people of their time, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so many of the people you mentioned in that long list of who these women are, you know, weren't famous authors. So where are you finding their poetry?
Oh, a few different places. The authors for whom we only have a couple of poems, they're often published in periodicals. So titles that you'd probably assume are going to contain comic verse, like The Comic Offering or The Idler, but also, you know, Blackwood's, Chambers, Edinburgh Magazine, all of these sorts of big publications will often come across women poets and then have to scan through and find the funny ones. But there are also lots of women who just published maybe one collection of their own poetry and then, you know, fell into obscurity. It's just been lots of searching, following lots of, you know, going down lots of rabbit holes and trying to find these women. And so I think we're also quite conscious that there will be lots of women that we've not found yet or that we've overlooked or... So, for example, there's one really funny writer of nonsense verse I only found a couple of weeks ago who was publishing just with initials in The Idler as MKH, But for some reason, I've thought, oh, this is really good nonsense verse. I need to find out if a woman wrote this, and did find reference to Mary Kernahan Harris publishing this verse. She published a whole collection of her nonsense verse. We can't find anywhere, but thankfully Jasmine's managed to get hold of a copy so that we can, you know, put it on the site. But yeah, it's lots of following kind of trails and using our nose to sniff out these poems.
There must be women as well who did this in ways which you're never likely to find, like women who just wrote funny poems for their friends and put them in letters and birthday cards and so on. It must be the dream that somebody will clear out an attic and send you a bunch of like never before published or seen funny poems that some kind of lady wrote in 1860.
I mean, reading through Mary Coleridge's letters was a bit like that for me. You kind of find these little funny pieces written to friends and family. So I imagine this is just the tip of the iceberg. There is so much more out there. It's just being able to dig it up and find it.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. We did an episode of the podcast towards the end of last year about satire and the Brontes, didn't we? So it was like the Brontes doing satire, but also satire of the Brontes. But the example you found of them being satire was their juvenilia, wasn't
yes,
it? It was
kind of
written for them, satirizing the other members of the family amongst themselves. And I suppose that question of was it supposed to be comic is to some extent answered if it's appearing in a publication with a name like Comic Poems.
Just to go back to that point that I was making earlier, that it feels like a piece in the puzzle to say, like, yes, women were doing and thinking all of these things and they weren't all kind of performing in the cliched ways that we sometimes think that we can divide, or that 19th century women themselves divided themselves into, like, I'll be an angel in the house, you be a fallen woman, angel, angel, fallen, fallen, like, and that we can read the literature and decide who was, you know, basically I'm saying that there's this perception that it's very binary, that it's very limited, that women aren't really interested in or aren't able to participate in all kinds of spheres of life that they are today. Why, how might it challenge, or what perceptions might it challenge about the 19th century to have this collection, to have this kind of ever-growing bank of evidence of the things they were doing and writing about and the ways in which they were being funny?
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways it is true that there were still many, many women who weren't able to participate in society in the same way as men, because of the social injustices that existed at that time. I think what's kind of interesting to me is that it shows us that women weren't sitting pretty within that 19th century patriarchal sphere.
Yeah.
They were actually kicking against it. They were defying it. They were spitting in the face of it. So, you know, we have 1,000 poems here which demonstrate that women weren't these kind of dull or dim-witted or simpering, pinafore-wearing angels in the house. They were far more often kind of bold, rude, arch, witty, and, you know, fiercely clever. And what's nice is that there isn't that binary of angel or fallen. These are ordinary women. And so it feels so relatable when you read through them. You just feel like you kind of get it. And I really hope that the collection will also crush any perceptions that women of that era weren't funny. And that they weren't good comic versifiers, because there are hundreds of poems here which show women using verse in incredibly dexterous and witty ways.
I mean, I think it's such a valuable collection because it explodes those assumptions about 19th century women, but also I think about, as an 18th century is looking in, about the 19th century more generally, you know, that it's all kind of like stiff upper lip and repressed and stuff, because there's all this funny stuff, but also about satire. I mean, we spoke to Andrew Bricker, who's written a wonderful book about libel and lampoon in the 18th century. And we said to him, why does it stop where it does, like towards the end of the 18th century? And he said, well, that's because that's where people think the great age of satire finishes. Like he didn't think that, but he was like, that tends to be, you have the great age of satire and then it sort of finishes around the French Revolution. But it doesn't go away. And I think that the kinds of people who are writing these poems, the kinds of things I write in poems about, show that like satire maybe had a moment of being voguish in the early 18th century, but it's still happening. So I think that's another interesting.
And I suppose we look for what we expect to find in any given period, don't we? If we've decided the 18th century is the age of satire, we go looking for the satire in it and assume that anything that happens outside of it is kind of anomalous. Do you have any favourite poems from your collection?
I have so many favourites. It's really, really hard to choose. But one poem that I really love, and I suppose I should probably shouldn't have chosen that because I've already spoken about Mary Coleridge before, but it's called A Clever Woman, which is essentially about a young woman's encounter with a patronising man, probably of her age, who can't believe that she's clever. And as a result, he tries to belittle her and assert his male superiority over her by calling her manly. So I'll read a couple of stanzas. You thought I had the strength of men, because with men I dared to speak, and quoted science now and then, and studied Latin for a week. But woman's woman, even when she reads her ethics in the Greek. You thought me wiser than my kind. You thought me more than common tall. You thought because I had a mind that I could have no heart at all. But woman's woman, you will find, whether she be great or small. So, I mean, there's another stanza too, but I just think it's remarkable how much suppressed bitterness there is in the comic voice here. It's just like, whoa. And also, there's a wonderful triumph in the way the female poet overmasters her male challenger by ventriloquizing him. You know, some of his words are even in quotations on the page. And in so doing, sort of ridiculing him, and words like dared, caught, and kind, loaded with this Socratic irony. In a sense, she's saying, no, I'm not clever and like a man. I'm clever and like a woman. She sort of outsmarts him through the verse and her skill with it. And I love that kind of comic tone. And that coded anger is actually a really interesting trend in the collection, the way that comedy is used to kind of sound out bitterness or even rage. I just find that so fascinating.
Yeah, and it's such an enduring trope, isn't it, to say because she's clever or because she's strong or brave, she lets comedically pretend to. And like, it reminds me of The Mill on the Floss, where they keep saying, it's so weird how Maggie's clever. It must be that she was meant to be a boy. If something's gone wrong, yeah. She's got mixed up. She must be like actually a boy, and we've got it all the wrong way around. And it's a really kind of ongoing sexist trope, isn't it?
Yeah. And there's so much of that, of just the women, they've had enough.
So a poem like that, who's the reader, the intended reader for a poem like that?
You know, it's so tricky, isn't it? Because I think the intended reader is sort of people who were on the side of the kind of feminist, the stirrings, the first wave of feminism. In other words, you know, here's just a typical man who's just belittling me. And you should all realise that I don't really appreciate it, and it's kind of normal for women to be clever too. I think it's sort of all sorts of, I mean, I think it was first published in her poetry. She was quite kind of quiet about publishing, but some of the poems are sort of for a wider audience. So they're published in periodicals, in fact, a lot of them. So they have a kind of more of a kind of wider readership or intended readership. It's hard to tell, because sometimes it feels like it's for a friend and other times it feels like it's got a really broad attention. So yeah, I mean,
one of the things we talk about a lot in lots of different contexts is like a function of satire is to generate solidarity and to have a moment where, I mean, Robert Fidian talks about the CAD emotions, contempt, anger and disgust, to be able to like give license to those feelings. And it just sounds like that's precisely what this poem is doing. Heather, did you have a favourite poem?
I did, and I was just thinking in terms of trying to imagine who the intended audience is, or kind of whose side you're supposed to be on. A poem that I came across recently has a lot in common with a few poems I found that are at once satirising blue stockings, but possibly from the perspective of a blue stocking, an educated woman who... Well, here's the thing. I hope this is from the perspective of a woman who is saying, why are women having a go at other women? But it could just be having a go at women. So I'll read you a verse from The Dames of the Olden Time. This is by Louisa Ann Meredith in about 1835. So it starts with a little introduction saying the following pathetic poem was discovered among the posthumous papers of the late Anthony of Antiquarius Esquire, who died of a violent attack of bas-bleu-phobia, occasioned, it is said, by a bite from a lady in a rabid state whose disorder had taken the awful turn called political economy. So it starts, I'll sing you a song tonight, a song of the good old days, of the fair and stately dames of old and all their ancient ways, when cookery books alone were read and she won the greatest praise, who could with fair and dexterous hands a pie crust highest raise. They were fair and thrifty housewives then, the dames of the olden time. And it goes on and, you know, says, why are women trying to be scientists? Why are they getting involved in politics? And at the end, shun crucible and eke retort, seek no poetic bays, but spin and sew, knit, cook and brew as in the golden days when British dames were housewives good. Alas, the olden times. So as Jasmine was saying, it can be really difficult to know exactly what position this speaker is taking and whether we're joining in or they're satirizing the satirizer, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, it reminds me of
those. It's very punchy.
Yeah, it's like those, you know, those kind of social media posts like, hey, kids of the 90s, remember when we used to go out and we didn't have to come in till nightfall and our mums would give us like 5p to go and get some dinner from the chippy and we never came to any harm. And that's a genre in itself. But then there's a kind of satirical genre of that, and it, where it's like, oh, yeah. And remember how like we graze ourselves on a rusty nail and then die of tetanus. And so like where you're kind of satirizing that post.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Jasmine, your poem also was making me think of another genre of social media post, which is the kind of post that ostensibly says, like, to the person who did this, you know, to the woman who pushed in front of me in the queue. And obviously it's not to the woman, is it? It's
no,
this woman was an idiot, but it's ostensibly addressed to them. So I don't know what my point is. Social media is like everything that's ever been, but worse. I don't know.
And just kind of like, yeah, creating a collective voice out of, yeah, kind of one experience. And they do that so well and really cleverly. And I think it kind of becomes its own kind of community. You have, I mean, a lot of these women knew each other. They read each other's works and they admired each other, criticized each other. And so you have this big thousands of poems. And when you have them all in your head swimming around, it just becomes this real kind of community of voices speaking together, sometimes against one another, but it's really interesting how the collective is made use of through comedy.
Where next for the comic women's poetry of the 19th century? Are you do you expect to just keep on and on expanding it? Are there other things you want to do with it?
I my fellowship ends in September this year, so that will be the end of funding for this project unless I can find some other resources or funds to keep going. What I really would love to do at some point is to extend it out internationally. So there's so many American women of the 19th century who are just such great comedians, comedian poets. I would love to explore that. In terms of just this project, the rest of the year we'll just be really building our biographies, building the timeline, just so that it is the fullest expression of what it can be as a kind of research resource, and a kind of public place for the public to go as well. So those are kind of immediate and long-term goals. I don't know if Heather has some other.
Yeah. So just to say, we're at, I checked this morning, we're at 1,023 poems on the website. So we busted our challenge of getting to 1,000 poems, and we've still got more in our personal list to keep adding. And we're at 230 poets, and we really hope to get to at least 250. But yes, otherwise we'll be trying to find and add more biographies, especially for the women poets about whom there isn't very much information out there. Sometimes we're having to find this information through their own introductions to their poetry collections or through little snippets taken from other periodicals and places like that. So yeah, there's an awful lot more information that we want to add to the site.
Amazing. Well, thank you for doing this project, because I mean, it's so useful. Mm. It's just such a wonderful resource, and I think people can use it for entertainment. I think it's going to lend itself so nicely to people teaching the 19th century, I think, as well. So yeah,
that was one of my goals, because I was a teacher and a lecturer before I became a kind of research fellow, and I just thought, where are all the gals? Like, where I was teaching comedy of the 19th century, and there's just all these male voices, and I thought, oh come on, I want my students to hear what the girls have to say, what the women have to say. So yeah, it was definitely with teaching in mind to kind of help teachers by providing that resource for them and their students.
Amazing.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for making time to talk to us. That's been fascinating and comic, and yeah. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Well, I really enjoyed talking to Heather and Jasmine, did you?
I did. And we should say as well, not only are we grateful to them for their time of talking to us and for making this amazing
we're
project.
We're grateful twice.
Yeah, they've been extremely patient with us. We had to interview them twice after we had a massive, the file was corrupt on the first recording. We had to interview them again. It's taken about 6 months since we first spoke to them to broadcast this interview. We think it was 100% worth it. Can't wait to spend more time on that database.
Yeah.
But we are enormously grateful to both of them for their time.
They have been incredibly patient and generous with their time. So,
There is one more thing that I did thought we could talk about whilst we were talking about satire. So are you aware that a journalist leaked lots of text messages, lots of WhatsApp messages from
Matt
Hancock?
I'm not aware of that, conscious of it or mindful of it, no.
No. So Matt Hancock gave all of his WhatsApp messages to a woman called
Isabel Oakeshott, I am aware.
Who has a record for burning sources. She's leaked all kinds of things.
Well, she was ghostwriting for him, wasn't she? Mm. And then, so he gave her all of them, and then she leaked them all.
She leaked them all.
Yeah.
And they are from the pandemic. Matt Hancock was the health secretary during the pandemic, and makes for some pretty extraordinary reading.
Yeah, it's all died away a bit now, hasn't it? Because first we got excited about Gary Lineker, and then other things happened. But this was, it was a bit like Partygate, wasn't it, for a week or so? More WhatsApp messages coming out every day.
Yeah. But what it reminded me of is there's a regular feature in The Private Eye, which started in 2021, which is it's whoever the Prime Minister is that week. It's their private WhatsApp group, as imagined by writers at The Private Eye. This replaced a feature they had during 2020, which was Boris Johnson's Facebook update. But I just thought it's extraordinary, because when you see the it's not a surprise, is it? Because it's people, they're double-end encrypted WhatsApp messages between colleagues being flippant about their working life. I'm not defending them, but I can see how they came.
Well, and that's the thing, isn't it? WhatsApp is very safe. It's double-end encrypted unless you give all your WhatsApps to Isabel Oakeshott.
That's right,
I heard somebody say on Twitter.
Yeah, yes. So they're being very glib in these messages. And we'll look at some of the real messages first. But I thought we could just have a look at some of the Private Eye ones. So this feature predates the revelation of these WhatsApp messages.
They do something similar in The Times as well. Hugo Rifkin does one.
Oh, he's intermittently quite funny, isn't he?
Yeah. Just good telly review.
I thought we could read one of these out.
Yeah.
And then look at some real ones and compare them.
Now, says Rishi, on with the important work of winning the next election. Let me announce my secret weapon, deputy chairman of the party, the guy who's going to deliver us the Red Wall seat single-handed. Welcome, Lee. That's Lee Anderson, 30p Lee, isn't it?
Lee Anderson. Yeah. Fuck off, you southern twats. Dominic Raab. I like the sound of him.
Why is Dominic Raab talking like that?
Oh, I thought that was Lee Anderson speaking. Sorry, Lee Anderson.
Dominic Raab. I like the sound of him.
You can fuck off too, you limp-wristed nonce. You call yourself a bully.
I say, Rishi, what a capital idea. Getting in someone even more unpleasant than Dominic, and he's actually working class. How marvellous.
Oh, the fuck are you, posh boy?
He really is authentically ghastly, and he's even called Lee. The oiky voters are going to love him.
So it goes on like that.
Don't you hate it the way when people are writing northern accents phonetically, they always write fook.
Yeah.
Like, we don't say it like it's got loads of O's in it.
No, and also I am... Well, many people would suggest I'm from the north. I believe I'm
more
from
northern
the north,
than you.
But then people sometimes say, well, you're not really from the north. And No, some contrarians think that I'm not from the north.
Yeah.
But I don't write in northern dialect often, not intentionally. Sometimes I might get was and were mixed up when I'm typing.
Yeah.
But I don't sit there like taking the H E out of the and stuff.
Yeah. Are you coming to pub?
Yeah.
Fuck.
I don't do that. But no, so that's just a little glimpse into what these are like. But they have fun with
it. I really missed the point there. Actually, it's not about the fook, is it? It's about the idea that it's funny to see what it might look like if these people were writing WhatsApp messages to each other.
And there's in the one that we're looking at right now with our eyes, there's a joke where Boris Johnson makes a comment and then the administrator removes him, and then Liz Truss makes a comment and the administrator removes her. They're all things that you might see in a real WhatsApp.
And we did. We'd see that sort of thing in real WhatsApp correspondence, didn't we? Yeah.
So let's have a look at some real ones now then. Those were joke ones. I didn't have any of the old private eyes that had the Matt Hancock WhatsApp message pretend ones in, but here's some real ones.
So Matt Hancock messages to Gavin Williamson about delaying A-level exams. Cracking announcement today. What a bunch of absolute arses the teaching unions are.
And Sir Gavin replied, I know, they really, really do just hate work.
In response, Mr. Hancock returned 2 laughing out loud and a bullseye emoji.
What do you think that's like? You've hit the point, hit the nail on the head.
It's like, lol, you're absolutely right,
yeah.
I'd say.
Isn't it?
Yeah, a bullseye emoji.
Speaking of targets.
Okay. Yep. So this was the first one that came out, wasn't it, when he texted George Osborne, who was editing the Evening Standard, and said, can you do me a favourable front page? Because I want to get to 100,000 daily COVID tests.
Mm-hmm.
And George Osborne replied, yes, of course. All you need to do tomorrow is give some exclusive words to the Standard and I'll tell the team to splash it.
And replying with a quote, Hancock later writes in capital letters, I want to hit my target.
And the editor answered bluntly, I gathered. Then he says, okay, but mass testing is going very well. No one thinks testing is going well, Matt, Mr. Osborne replied. So basically they are dismissive of teachers. Boris Johnson doesn't understand the statistics or what they are telling him about COVID and the likelihood of dying from it.
So when he said,
what is it, if you're over 65, your risk of dying from COVID is probably as big as your risk of falling down stairs, and we don't stop older people from using stairs, what do you think? What does he mean, what do you think?
That's Boris Johnson.
Yes, no, but I mean, you know, is Chris Wissi meant to reply, that's a good idea, we should stop older people from using stairs? Gavin Williamson needs a haircut. They are clearly talking about illegal gatherings and how they're going to manipulate the public response
and then
reaction.
This
and then the big one,
this is
wasn't
amazing.
It?
Like, amazingly awful.
Hancock's advisor saying, they're talking about how to impose stringent lockdown restrictions in December 2020. And Hancock's advisor says, rather than doing too much forward signalling, we can roll pitch with the new strain. And Matt Hancock replies, we frightened the pants off everyone with the new strain. But the problem is that everybody's talking too much about Brexit. And then Hancock asks, when do we deploy the new variant? Which I think was willfully misinterpreted as like Hancock had made a batch of new variant, but what he means is like, when are we going to unleash the news? And the thing is, I remember getting a text quite a few weeks before the whole Kent variant thing kicked off and before it became increasingly obvious something was going to happen to Christmas. But then it went away in the news. People weren't talking about it for a while, but there was this kind of vague knowledge that something was happening in London. And then no one, as I say, no one talked about it for a while, but then they waited until mid-December and changed all the rules about Christmas bubbles. I saw some people talking about this on Gogglebox, and when they were watching the news and it was quoted that we frightened the pants off everyone with the new strain, one of the people watching said, good, because people weren't taking it seriously. They needed to do that. But that's not what the point is it? The point, they aren't saying, like, we need to frighten them because it's that bad. They were saying, like, we need to frighten them to deflect attention from elsewhere.
Because Brexit's taking a top line.
Yeah. And then they talk about how you can show more visible kind of signals of compliance by enforcing more mask wearing because it's cheap and it looks visibly impactful, even though they're talking about how it doesn't make that much difference.
Yeah, but I mean,
a lot less difference than they were suggesting at the time.
But I encourage everyone to Google these and look at them because they're extraordinary, but also they're not, they're almost exactly the same as the private eye ones.
Yeah.
So, and I suppose it's unsurprising. So Private Eye, one of the jokes with the Private Eye item is, isn't it funny to see these politicians in our imagination speaking on WhatsApp the same way that we do, making the same jokes that a group of friends do? Of course they actually do that in real life. We just never thought we'd get to see the messages.
Thank you, Isabel Oakeshott, for everything you've done.
A lot more glib and dismissive of the situation. And they do give a startling insight into the scale, what Matt Hancock thinks the scale of the problem is. Like, they're thinking it's all about, they're not actually scared that bodies are going to be piled in the street, are they?
And the rationale behind a lot of the rules wasn't about, quote, following the science. So they say, somebody says, like, look, could we please look again at the rule of six insofar as it applies to children, because there's not really the evidence for that as being an important thing. And they're like, no, because if we give in on a small thing, we'll just look weaker. So, you know, children weren't allowed to see each other or spend time together.
Yeah.
Not because that was dangerous for them, but because the bigger message might have been felt to be compromised if there was a change on that.
Look at that one. We need to ramp up the messaging. The fear/guilt factor is vital.
Yeah.
Like, it's... yeah. Wow.
Well, haven't we come a long way from Frank Skinner at the beginning to this now? It's been a real grab bag of an episode, hasn't it?
It has. Well, it's been about satire.
Yes, it has been about satire. You've been in it and I've been in it, and there's been an ampersand. Yeah. So I think we've ticked all the boxes that we need to for this to be Smith and Ward Talk About Satire.
Absolutely, yeah. And we've tentatively suggested it might be time to redefine what satire is.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite big, isn't it?
Yeah, more on that anon.
Indeed.
But for now, what do people need to do if they've enjoyed the podcast?
Listen to more of the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get, like, sort of starry-eyed and misled by Frank Skinner. He's a Johnny come lately. We've been doing this for ages. Just remain calm and listen to Smith and Ward Talk About Satire.
Remember the tree.
We can hit
tree.
Trees, we just don't do it.
Yeah, we can be logocentric.
Tree. Yeah.
We could be logocentric in our scansion.
Yeah, exactly.
So
that's all, really.
I mean, what you could do is watch that and also listen to us, and then you gain loads of satire, but don't prioritise them over us.
Don't get Sky Arts just to watch that.
Not when you can get it for free from us. So send us an email at satirenomore@gmail.com if you enjoy what you're hearing. Rate and review us.
Rate and review us, for the love of God, yes.
Platform of choice. Give us a yell on social media, @satirenomore on Twitter, @talkaboutsatire on Instagram. And keep up the good listening.
Yes. Keep up the good listening.
Yeah. So without further ado.
Yeah. I think that's probably all the ado we need, isn't it?
Yeah. Sit up.
I don't. That's what I say. Sit up. Shut up.
Shut up.
And
eat our satire. Goodbye.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Should we delete that?
Well, we'll keep it for now. case for the blackmail files.